Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Unusually warm and dry describes our recent weather. And Bill and I, Bill's that molecule guy, you know. Anyway, we're out walking the cat. There's a jet flying overhead. And this is probably the last really warm day we're going to get for a while. But anyway, that warm and dry weather that's just unusually warm and dry, well, that's what Ken Lane was experiencing in the desert in December 7 years ago. Here in Montana in 2024, we will do well to listen to his insights in this episode from December 8th, 2017. And also an artist shares why she lives in the desert. So it's called Wildfires and Weird Times.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the Mojave and fire is on our minds tonight. Wildfire. Wildfires tearing through the dry chaparral terrain of the Southern California coastal mountains and canyons. A rich and often wild landscape of pine, oak, sycamore, fat with dry weeds. This December, an explosion of grasses and invasive weeds that grew up earlier this year after so many hard years of intense drought. And it all dried to a crisp in the searing summer that followed. Rain is not in our forecast in the deserts of California and Arizona and southern New Mexico over these next weeks. It's too warm for almost winter and there's no rain, and fire is a very big danger for all of us out here, whether alongside a nature preserve or a national forest or a national monument. These more or less natural and protected lands around our giant cities are things we have because we wisely chose to keep them intact, but we also love putting our houses right up against these places, the urban wildland interface, as often described by the biologists and the firefighters. I tell you, I am as guilty as they come when you're talking about human habitation right on the edge of the wilderness. Right on the edge of a preserve or a natural park or the national forest, I want to walk out my door and into the desert, into the rocks, onto the trail, down the river, up the coast, up the mountain. My God, you make a bargain when you live out where you can breathe. And that bargain goes something like, well, there are no jobs and not much in the way of restaurants, and bookstores are few and far between, and good luck trying to get a decent cocktail, although you can get good beer and spirits. You can get organic wine at the health food store, but you make trade-offs. You consider the quality of life, and if your quality of life requires a lot of open space and quiet and clear, bright skies, well, you can rule out the oyster bar, sadly. And you pay a premium on your homeowner's insurance because, of course, that big fire could come any day, at any hour, at an hour of its own choosing, like a thief in the night. Like a thief in the night, like the thief who pried the water heater off the side of a certain homestead cabin desert magazine office in Joshua Tree on the highway, the one with the yellow and black sign out front. The urban planners, generally a thoughtful bunch even when their thoughts proved wrong, like to talk about the problems of homes along the urban wildland interface as if there was a way to completely avoid it. There's always a frontier. Always a line between one thing and another. A transition zone if we are lucky. An abrupt boundary like a highway or a wall in most cases. And in a place like Southern California or metropolitan Phoenix or Las Vegas or Salt Lake City or Reno or the desert suburbia of the Antelope Valley or Yucca Valley or Victorville or Pahrump, that interface is likely to be desert. Low desert, high desert, desert woodland, desert riparian, and in these strange, if not unexpected new times, it will be useful to figure out ways to make these habitations more resistant to fire. There is a fine old structure in Yosemite Valley called the Awani Hotel, which was designed within the regular reality of forest fires. The timbers you see on the building exterior are made of concrete, molded from the real thing so that wildfires could not ignite the now historic hotel in that usual way. Adobe is fire resistant, even if the roofing is often flammable. But a single-story wood-framed house is particularly suited to earthquake country. A stud-built cabin can withstand just about anything, except fire and neglect. Almost any house or homestead will retreat into the landscape after an uncertain number of years of abandonment. I like those Tunisian, mostly underground dome houses like you see in Star Wars. The moisture farm on the desert planet where Luke Skywalker lives in the movie. Luke's family house in that 1977 movie was a traditional Tunisian residence that had been converted into a hotel, and it's still there, last I heard. You can even build such a thing out here in the American desert. Watch out for the radon gas. The CalEarth Institute out in the western Mojave has a method for making sturdy desert homes out of thin bags of whatever dirt or sand or gravel is on the ground at the home site. The finished homes look ancient and futuristic all at once. There are earth bag buildings around the world in the West Bank and in Arizona, Joshua Tree and Pioneer Town, Lucerne Valley, Johnson Valley. One of these earthbag buildings famously survived the big earthquake in Nepal in 2015. Some people want to live in shipping containers. Some people like barns or condos or live-work studios or yurts or apartment courts or houseboats. It doesn't much matter as long as you are comfortable and as long as your home won't easily catch fire or tumble in an earthquake or a hurricane or a tornado. The problem at this moment in time in the West is that the combination of very dry air and very strong winds and lots of dry fuel up and down the canyons makes nearly anything fuel for the savage wildfire. A very fine home in Ventura County burned up on Tuesday after initially surviving the firestorm that raged over the fancy neighborhood. With a copper roof and aluminum-clad doors, the home had been specially built for wildfire country. But as San Francisco Chronicle reporter Lizzie Johnson wrote, when the family returned after the initial danger had passed, simply opening a closet door brought in an invisible supply of oxygen that turned an errant ember into an inferno instantly, and the people ran for their lives. Everything was lost. It is a common misperception that the desert is immune to wildfire, but wherever there is fuel, there is always the possibility of fire. The sand dunes of Imperial or Cadiz or Kelso even have enough fuel here and there, but the real threat lies in the canyons, upon the mountain ridges, and the fragile zones of pinyon and juniper at the higher elevations. A blaze tore through Mid Hills Campground, my favorite campground in the Mojave, many years back, taking down a whole forest of pinyon that had shaded people and animals for many centuries. Your simpler acquaintances probably like to post those I love science memes on Facebook and whatever, but the truth is that lots of science is new. Fire science is new and it is hardly perfected. You've got relatives older than the relatively new and rapidly evolving discipline of wildfire management. Over most of the 20th century, when a fire broke out in the West, we put it out as fast as we could, and then we slowly figured out that burns were part of the Western ecosystem. We began to let some fires burn, began to even start fires when the level of fuel on the ground was too high, too dry. Controlled burns, they're called. Except who can control a wildfire once it's out of control? That's what happened at Mid Hills and Mojave National Preserve. I've heard certain old cranks in the vicinity rant and rave about that particular fire and get so wound up in conspiracy theory that they've made a whole narrative about people, California firefighters in particular, conspiring to intentionally burn up the prettiest high country in the preserve. And you know, that is a pretty offensive thing to come up with, but people do get cranky as hell when they live out alone in the desert. So I've heard. Before the preserve was part of the National Park System, back when it was still the East Mojave National Scenic Area, I spent some time with the firefighters who lived out there, who bunked in a double wide for months at a time. They risked their lives and left their families to be ready to battle walls of flames through desert canyons, to dig fire lines by hand in 110-degree heat. I remember one particular night in the middle 1980s when I sat up for hours with a couple of these guys, the ones who were off duty and therefore allowed to have a beer or two before bed. Some were veterans, some were right out of forestry school, some were seasonal workers giving it a try, seeing if they liked the work, if they liked the isolation. We told each other stories and watched the occasional set of headlights bump up the dirt road in the distance. The busiest night of the year, deer season. Deer season started in the morning, and there must have been 10 or 12, maybe 15 vehicles that headed up that dusty grade over the course of the night before I finally turned in, sleeping on the floor of the trailer, kindly invited inside by these firefighters. Everybody makes mistakes, and as a species, we are very good at making mistakes, but blaming firefighters for not always being able to turn off the fury of nature like a light switch, well, that just seems a bit unfair. A decade back, 11 years, in fact, a number of devastating wildfires tore through the high desert, through the small Mojave Desert communities of Yucca Valley, Pioneer Town, Pipes Canyon, and across parts of Joshua Tree National Park, the northwestern part up around Covington Flats. It burned right up to the patio of my old place in Yucca Valley. The Joshua Trees went black on the north side, where the fire raged by. But the other side of the trees lived. They were weird-looking trees, weirder than usual for Joshua trees, but we loved them all the more because they had survived. Eventually, a wet winter came around, some dustings of snow, and sure enough, bright green, new, spiky branches began shooting right out of the ground, all that energy waiting to be triggered. I've talked to a lot of people who know a lot about invasive species, and they often talk about the culprit in many of these desert firestorms. Invasive weeds like red brome, which you'll see all over Joshua Tree National Park, all over the transition zones on the transverse ranges. Red brome looks like stubby wheat, reddish-green in color depending on the season. The seeds and oily fuel to carry flames from, say, a juniper on the ridge to a pinyon 10 feet away to a Joshua tree down the hill to some cat claw down in the wash, and the hotter it gets, the less these Joshua trees and juniper and pinyon woodlands come back. I've been running around here for 35 years now in places that were once shady refuge for pinyon jays and sweaty hikers just aren't there anymore. It's not cold enough in the winter anymore to get that little bit of snow these trees need. You still see the dead trunks here and there. Those great long pinyon trunks, you see the charcoaled stubs of junipers on the ridge, not enough of the living trees though. One reason I love the Eastern Sierra Desert so much is I still see pinyon saplings. I come back to the same place the next or the next season and they're growing into sturdy little conifers. Laura Paskus wrote a very good piece for the Santa Fe Reporter last year. It's called So Long Farewell, and you should look it up. It's about the high desert forests dying off in New Mexico, and it's a little bit sad, but nothing is permanent. Permanence does not exist. There is now. There is the past we know about. There is the past we don't know about. And there is, from our view anyway, an immense and unknown future. Sometimes we get a little peek at it if we open our minds to such things. But it is never settled completely because you, we, us, the things we do will affect what comes next. One day, hopefully soon enough that I'm around to see it, we'll get ahead of all this, one way or another. If we live that long. A little cooler in the winter, a little more snow, and our pinyons and our junipers and our Joshua trees will start sprouting up again. They'll come back. There is nothing nicer than seeing new trees coming up on a high desert mountain. This is Desert Oracle Radio. The artist and filmmaker and all-around desert character, Kate McCabe, was kind enough to invite us to her Kidnap Yourself headquarters up on Yucca Mesa, where we sat at her kitchen table and talked about art and the desert and dogs.
Let's just get this straight. I came here for rock and roll. I didn't come here for the art scene. My first friends were rock and rollers. The legacy of that's kind of what's in my work, too. Well, I think the whole legacy of the rock and roll vortex, yeah, it goes way beyond the people who brought me here, for sure. I mean, I'll never deny the Graham Parsons pull of the place. And how many people loved Graham Parsons? Like, I didn't even know how many people loved him until I moved here and had friends visit me that, like, had to go visit that. But no, I first was filming on the Rancho de la Luna compound. I made a feature film called Stabia for Brant Bjork. And Brant, at the time, was living on that property in one of the houses. There are three houses in the compound, the recording studio and two other houses. And I just saw the way they lived and was immediately like, well, what am I, hello? Like, what am I doing? Like, this is how I want to live. So it just made sense to me to come here immediately and work on the film. Like, I'd saved up enough money too. But I basically worked on that film for a year, like, out of this house. And got to just, like, live that dream of just making your work all the time. So I can't compare it to art scenes that way, but the people I met there, of course, they leave half the year. And that's when I realized I needed other friends, too. I was like, oh, maybe I should have some friends in the art scene or something. That, you know, rock and roll gives you great friends, but, yeah, then they leave. But people from Europe, England, like, South America, everywhere, came to visit them. So as their friend, I got to participate in these amazing, like, kind of rock and roll cultural comings together, because that's what happens. They meet all these amazing friends on the road, and then they come to the desert because they want to make music here. So I had access to a really amazing, beautiful group of people for, like, the first 6 years I was here. You know, I'm trying to travel with my films now, and I'm trying to... My experience has broadened beyond that circle, and they're still doing it, though. I mean, Iggy Pop was just I mean, I'm kind of sad that I'm not as closely knit. I'm like, oh, damn. Totally miss when Iggy Pop came to visit, but that's okay. But that's how strong the pull is. You know, especially the way I wanted my house to be a conduit of creativity. That happens here for musicians, I feel like. They're drawn to the desert. They want to come write songs. I've actually written more songs here, and I'm not a musician. The artists that have come here came out of necessity because I got divorced. So first I was like, how do I maintain this place? You know, and I would work long hours. I had a dog. So I loved the idea of kind of having temporary roommates. So the deal was that they had to be working on a project. So it didn't matter if they were a jazz singer from New Orleans or a Jay Babcock counterculture writer. He stayed here for 2 months. Yeah. Or Anna Christie. No one usually stays more than 6 months is a little like long because I like also living alone. Yeah, I've had painters and dancers and glassblowers and all kinds of interesting people. And it's, so the house becomes a launching pad for their desert adventure because many of them already were drawn here but weren't sure yet where they were going to go or if they were going to build or buy or rent or stay or who knows. So usually I feel like 50% of the people that have stayed here even briefly have found their space in the desert. Kidnapping yourself is important. The desert can be a really lonely place. You know, I'm a loner, right? I'm not going to be without something interesting to do, read, write, or whatever. You know, just taking a walk is enough sometimes, you know. So I think maybe instinctively and intuitively I was kind of made for this environment. Dating is hard, I won't lie. I don't even let people know don't tell them I'm single.
Delete.
It was accidental that, it was definitely beginner's luck that I ended up here because we bought the house in the rain. It was almost an El Nino-y kind of winter that winter. So I didn't realize how special this particular property was because I was looking for something that had trees because you can tell the older homestead cabins, the people were thinking about shade. They were thinking about, well, I would like to eat pomegranates. Let's have a pomegranate tree here. I have a fig tree on this property I didn't even realize, you know. And then the spring came. It was covered in wild daisies. This higher elevation gets a little more snow than, say, like downtown Joshua Tree. So we have also a really long, extended wildflower bloom in the spring. But all of this happened because I found a puppy that was 4 months old after I'd lived here 6 months. Right out front on my land. And we ended up keeping this dog, who eventually became known as Pickles the dog. And this space is special because there's like 160 undeveloped acres across in that view to Pipes Canyon to the west. So it's got this, everyone here has a panoramic view. If I may interrupt myself, I should warn everybody in the desert that if someone invites you to a place you've never been, you have to say yes, because each desert perspective is unique. So it's one of my rules that I live by here. Someone invites me to a new place, even if I'm dying or like with deadlines, I like 99% of the times I have to go because I'll never get to see that unique corner of the desert again, you know. But this higher elevation is cool, but this dog was crazy, like feral, amazing, bunny-eating puppy. So I had to train it, I had to walk it, I had to tire it out. So I learned how to be in the desert walking this dog. And I had the DIVORCE, so the dog helped me meditate through like a heartbreak. Like that was a 10-year relationship going, you know, down the tubes. So that dog actually, even though she was wild and terrible and really hard to train, chasing her through the desert while she's trying to kill bobcats or whatever, gave me a way to meditate that I wasn't even aware that I had in me. It's a lot different than for running the train because you're going to be late, you know, like walking in the desert. So, I don't know. It's been nice up here. I kind of don't want to leave this part of the desert. Like, I'm kind of a Mesa person now, forever probably, but the dog just passed away. So I've been asking friends to go with me and usually to go for walks with me. And usually they say yes, and that's what Pickles would say, so it's been nice. But I still now have this practice walking that keeps me connected to the desert that I have to keep doing. This time of year, you can walk any time of day. You don't have to wait till the end of day. You could go at noon or 10 and, you know, not be dying in the heat. And you can relax a little more. That's the only thing I like about walking in the winter, is that you can daydream more. You can have your head in the clouds with your feet on the earth, whereas you have to kind of be a vigilant snake watcher outer, you know, in the warmer weather. I love walking in the desert. It's kept me sane. I started writing about living in the desert. So it started as a comic book, like a sketchbook, and I self-published it, and it's called Mojave Weather Diaries. And I think I started in 2009, and it became kind of a daily journal, but also inspired by how sailors would kind of keep logs, or since I'm from Philly, how Ben Franklin had his Poor Richard's Almanac, you know, like words of wisdom and bad stories and bad jokes, and also what the clouds look like. My name is Kate McCabe, and we're on a little cabin on Mesa in Yucca Mesa, and I've been here almost 13 years, and I made a space that's a conduit for creativity. That's what I use this house for.
That is it for us for this week. I want to thank you all for listening, for coming out to the 10 shows and events Desert Oracle has done over this weird year. It has been very nice to meet all you good people, in moderation, of course. And our Campfire Stories program at the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs has been extended January 4, February 1, March 1, each of those dates being the first Thursday of the month, 7 p.m. around the campfire, Yucca Man and UFOs and murderers and monsters, bring the kids the desert stories of our strange and unusual land await. And how about Desert Oracle, our guide to the American desert? Pick up a copy at the Hoof and the Horn or the Pioneertown General Store or the 29 Palms Visitor Center on Highway 62 or Skylight Books in Los Angeles, one of my favorite bookstores in the world. I used to live right down the street from there years ago, decades ago. As for the new issue, I swear to God I'm toiling over the thing, and we'll get there soon. Lucky issue number 7. Soon, soon, I ask for your patience and prayers and etc. For that reason, because the book must be finished, we will not have a new episode next week, but there will be a Christmas week episode. Oh, we're going to be saying Merry Christmas to each other, whether we like it or not. It'll be something else. We'll be broadcasting a few programs that fell through the cracks here at the radio station in Joshua Tree as well. Thank you for your letters, for your suggestions, for your subscriptions. You can write to us at P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California. You can send us email. The address is radio@desertoracle.com. DesertOracle.com is also where you'll find us on the internet. Around and across the Mojave, from Amboy to Zizix, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you for listening, and good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM. Whew, I'm going up a little hill. Okay, so now for something just a little different. Do you know any ranchers here in Montana that had this sort of thing happen and are willing to talk about it? This was released December 6th, 2019, and it's titled The Hungry Demons.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and so has the fog. It's a spooky and beautiful thing to see your usual dried-up desert all covered in fog, and with some kind of wet stuff on the ground, too. It does not appear to be blood. I think it's rainwater, by God. By Jove, as we should say this time of year. You know, it rained maybe a little in the desert. And you look at your phone or your computer, and everybody is posting pictures of the little bit of snow, the puddles of rainwater, the fog, the storm clouds, San Gorgonio all topped with white, our own high desert Christmas tree out here. A lovely thing to see. And one thing everybody says when you mention the rain, the snow, whatever moisture falls to the earth, we need it. Everybody says that. We need it. I guess it's to head off any complaints, as people do tend to complain about the weather. Sure is a little bit rainy out, you might say to your neighbor or the bartender or etc. The emergency room doctor, the roofing guy who comes by and bums you out with a lot of, oh, this is going to be bad, this is going to hurt, and then, of course, you never hear from the roofer again. Prank contractors, very common in the high desert. I think it might be a cult of some kind. They earn points by showing up at somebody's place and telling them a lot of horror stories, and then they drive away, never to be seen or heard from again. So maybe you say to somebody, it is raining a little bit, and they just bark it out quick. We need it. Yes, we need a little rain now and then, a little precipitation. Not too much. Don't want to overdo it. A couple of winter storms per year, maybe a couple of thunderstorms in monsoon season. That's plenty. Any more than that, and all of a sudden, it's not Desert Oracle Radio, it's Swamp Lake News or something. The Seattle Basement Full of Water Oracle. We think it's water. We hope it's rainwater, is what I mean. As Bob Dylan once sang, a lot of water under the bridge. A lot of other stuff, too. So happy winter storm season to you all. There's nothing like taking a walk up the hill, a walk up the canyon, the mountain, in that brisk morning air the day after a storm. Everything all clean and beautiful. The birds chirping happily. The coyotes joining together in their raintime Christmas carols. All the weird bugs flushed out of the weird holes in the corners of your house, staggering around in the cold. What a time. Some people think the state of Oregon means 1,000 strip clubs and bad Mexican food and constant rainfall and people shivering under the eaves, smoking cigarettes until they commit suicide. Well, that's actually Portland, and there's more to the state of Oregon than that scene. Half of Oregon is on the dry side, the desert side, the Intermountain West. And out there on that rangeland, because a lot of it's rangeland. There has been a gruesome mystery brewing up there, and I bet you want to know all about it. This story starts in late July. Late July of 2019 at a ranch that reaches up into the piney mountains of the National Forest about an hour north of Burns, eastern Oregon. This is where the bulls were found. Five of them. Five bulls, all dead, all separated by a quarter mile. Meaning all in an area of about 1 square mile, no visible wounds, no sign of struggle, no broken bones. But each bull was missing its tongue and its sex organs. Nothing else, and those organs were removed with surgical skill. The ranch is a professional operation. It's owned by an out-of-town doctor. An animal doctor, in fact. The bulls were found dead on Sylvie's Valley Ranch, a good 15 miles from US 395, the closest real road. The ranch's vice president, Colby Marshall, believes the cattle were killed and mutilated a few days before they were found on the last 2 days of July of this year. No broken bones, no human footprints, tire tracks, no evidence of a helicopter having landed. Difficult country. Canyons and steep slopes. Boulders, rock piles, pine trees. The bulls were breeding bulls at the prime of their productive lives. Productive for the ranchers, anyway. Each of the bulls was worth $7,000. At times five, that's some real money. People take this stuff very seriously out in cattle country. According to the Oregonian newspaper, the crime, quote, spurred a multi-agency investigation in eastern Oregon. But detectives have turned up no leads and have not yet even settled on a cause of death. The same thing happened a year earlier, but in North Queensland in Australia. Five at a time again. This is what rancher Judy Cook had to say up in Cloverly Station. It's definitely not a person. That's what she told the North Queensland Register 2 Augusts ago. And then she says, whether it's a sophisticated robot or aliens, we just don't know. It's an hour's drive from here, and no one is getting down there without driving right by the house. There were absolutely no tracks, no blood, nothing. It's amazing to think there was no blood, and there's no way of cutting anything off with a knife as clean as that. These cattle were missing certain parts, again, cut clean away. An udder, a tongue, that kind of thing. Again, no suspects, no arrests. Anybody who ever needed a cop knows the cops are mostly interested in property. And drugs, I guess. And anything involving guns. But property, really more than anything. And out on the range, the main thing of financial value, cattle, livestock. Cattle grazing on public lands, mostly. The land itself, natural gas, fracking, mining, All that sort of welfare industry, welfare for industry. People stay out. No protesting either. Boy, they'll pretty much kill you for protesting an oil pipeline through an Indian reservation, and they get away with it, too. You know, they put a guy in prison for a couple of years for bidding on a public lands oil lease because he had no intention of using the lease. Federal prison for that. Anyway, this incident up in Oregon, up north of Burns. You might remember this is the same part of the world where that spin-off Bundy gang went up and invaded a bird refuge. Because these are the craziest times, all dumb all the time. And the feds just left them up there. And these Bundy guys dug this trench with a bulldozer. And if I remember this right, it was a marked area for archaeological searches, for relics of the people who lived there long ago, thousands of years ago. And these clowns dug this trench and they filled it with their own excrement. How do you like that? Anyway, that's the area, in case you've never been up there. What a bunch of weirdos everywhere. Invading Area 51 to get the aliens, invading a bird refuge to leave a trench filled with frozen human crap. What a delightful time to be alive. I mean, it's actually a fine time to be alive, the best one we've got, and you know, it's perfectly all right to turn off the news for a couple of months every now and then. But that's the problem. It's all connected. Everything weird or absurd or nonsensical or immoral or conspiratorial is always connected. The great web of the asinine world. So because you keep up with the cattle mutilations and you keep up with the various industrial and intentional outrages committed upon our Western lands, our public Western lands and national forests and wildlife refuges and national monuments and all the rest. Well, then when you see where the cattle mutilations happened on public land in eastern Oregon, you know the Bundy bird nuttery happened right down the road. How do you leave anything out? What part's not relevant? This is an ongoing thing, the cattle mutilations, and it's 100% weird. There are no cults cutting up cattle on ranch land. Despite 45 years of baffled cops blaming make-believe cults on a crime they cannot solve. Can't solve a spooky cattle rustling case, boys? Well, maybe you're not much good out here after all. Because it's a big crime, cattle crime. Now you can buy live cattle and kill them however you like. There are specific markets for this. And nobody asks how you plan to kill your cattle later. Nobody cares. Not in the cattle industry, anyway. Any cult that had the resources to own secret fleets of stealth helicopters and employed teams of expert surgeons could afford all the cattle they want. They could just buy a ranch and dissect away for whatever ritual purpose. When you go to the livestock market, there is no form that asks what kinds of robes you're going to wear when you kill the cattle. Nobody asks if you have a ceremonial dagger, or if you're gonna do it at midnight or on the Ides of March. Nobody cares. The animals are ultimately bought and sold to be turned into food. And even those productive bulls will eventually become meat food for somebody or something lower on the economic food chain. In the 1970s, ranchers in the West were well aware of the habit of cults setting up camp in rural areas on old ranches. Easy to hide out there. And if crazy murder gangs would go after people and houses for satanic purpose, well, maybe they would go after expensive cattle, too. That's kind of how the theory developed in the 1970s. Some people thought secret government groups might be responsible, especially after the Church Commission in the 1970s revealed all these wild mind control projects committed against American citizens. And could you really be surprised by something the federal government did in the early 1970s or today? What would surprise you? The only thing that would surprise me is if they were doing something without a monetary or political or personal gain. If you want to scare people about a particular topic, you do it because there's a result you want. Support in the election. Support if the election doesn't work out right. And there's always a grift. Always a con that goes with the rest. You never stop at one crime when you're in that business. You don't think, well, this one crime is big enough. Let's do that one and then lay low. Instead, you do three or four crimes at a time so you're not just funding an illegal war in Central America like in the 1980s. You also want to do some crimes in other places to fund the crimes in the first area of interest. And of course, everybody needs to profit along the way. It's like when you see a guy leading a high-speed chase on television and next he's doing a carjacking and a kidnapping and shooting the highway patrol cars and you think, you know, the first crime, you probably could have been out of jail in 2 years. And now look at you. Well, by then, they usually manage to get the cops to open fire. Well, I can't think of anybody who really gained from a half century of Western American cattle mutilations. Not the ranchers who at best could claim a little insurance money before getting cut off. When you have a lot of claims, your insurance keeps getting more expensive until nobody wants to insure you at all. It did not make law enforcement look good. They've never solved a single case of cattle mutilation. Not one. No arrests. No charges. Not even a suspect. Thousands of cattle mutilations. And that's after you leave out the ones with reasonable causes. Like predators who might take a calf or an old bull now and then. Take it and eat as much as they can. But the mutilated cows are untouched by predators, untouched by vulture or raven. They are cursed things. The largest manhunt in Colorado history occurred in the late 1970s as law enforcement from every type of local, state, and federal agency attempted to find a suspect for the wave of hundreds of mutilations in that state and in neighboring states. They reached into Kansas, into New Mexico, into Utah. No evidence but the dead animals. No arrest. No suspects. I mean, this has been going on since the Spanish were ranching Western North America hundreds of years ago. It seems to happen more often now. Either that, or it was so commonplace that there are few records of it from the Spanish and Mexican era, but livestock is money. It's why we still call investment stock today. And I can't imagine mysterious cattle mutilations would not be noted if happening in large numbers. Because it's happening in large numbers now, worldwide, and especially since the 1950s. It cannot possibly serve a scientific function for aliens or for Earthlings. Can you imagine having the technology to cross space or time or dimensions and you use this power to core out a lot of cow anuses year after year, decade after decade? It makes no sense. You could just take 100 head a year from all over the world and it would hardly be noticed, other than at the individual ranches. Cows do disappear. They are stolen. They are shot and eaten by country people out hunting what they call slow elk. They wander off and get hit by semi-trucks and fall in a ditch many miles from home and are just written off as lost, stolen, gone. If you wanted to take a lot of cattle and do whatever you liked, you could do that. If you had the technology and stealth to drop teams of precision cattle murderers on the ground and then get them out of there in minutes, no tracks, no evidence, no prints, you could breed every kind of cattle on Earth, even without genetic technology that would surely be available to an intelligence that can travel through space and time. You could make a lab where you only grow the parts you like. The tongues and the sex organs and the udders. Economies of scale. There is only one reason to do this to cattle on the range, and that's for people to know about it, to see it and be terrified. And let me add that the common side dish with cattle mutilation is the baffling sight of the night before. Of bizarre flashing lights, incredible strobes and bursts of energy over the site of the surgical massacre. Always somewhere inside the fencing, away from the road, somewhere hard to get to but still in sight. In fact, that's usually how people know where to look. They saw something, if not lights and a strange haze a half mile away on a clear western night, then maybe a ranch hand might notice a big circle pressed or swirled into the pasture the next day, right there where the dead cattle are set out like chess pieces. I've heard ranchers and cattle truck drivers talk about this stuff, and they have the same wild guesses we all have. But the one that makes some kind of sense is that these things that ritually massacre domestic cattle are literally demons. Not in a specific religious framework, but real forces of nature. Forces of nature we might as well call demonic. The words don't belong to a religion. There were demons a long time before there were any of the religions people came up with. You know that, right? Oh, there were angels, too. Every religion has demons. Every religion has angels. Every religion has the beam of light. It's like a hamburger stand having French fries. It just goes with it. And some of these still mysterious natural forces have a particular function, and that's to mess with our heads, freak us out, get our attention. A long time ago, people got the idea that killing a valuable food animal and offering it to the gods was a way to please the gods. Why do you think people did this same thing all over the world? All these populations of early humans as we settled into our more or less current species. Why did they all start killing some of their precious food animals and offering these animals to unseen gods? Or seldom seen gods, I guess I should say. Because now and then, oh, what a thing to start doing. No other animal does this, prepares a ritual meal for a supposedly higher species, a divine force or intelligence that happens to be mostly invisible. Could you do something about this drought? Whoever up there is controlling the weather? Was it as simple as that or as difficult as that? To come up with that all by yourself? I mean, that is high concept to decide the time had come to slaughter a valuable animal and have it invisibly consumed by something you can't see. And then, actually, you and your people eat the cooked flesh after the ceremony. You eat the burnt offering. You became aware of this invisible intelligence, and you and all the other people around the world decided the same thing. You just guessed that these invisible forces would enjoy this sort of thing. Sacrificing an animal to a god or a demon or something in between, like they mostly are, sounds savage to our modern ears, our woke eyes. But was it? Is it? The animals sacrificed to the gods were actually cooked and distributed to the people there. It was a barbecue, a religious barbecue. And patriotic, too. You burn stuff, you drink too much. Like how we Americans celebrate the 4th of July. You think about what an animal goes through today to become food without a face, and those sacrificial rites sound downright dignified, like the old Hebrew priest who had to rotate on and off sacrifice duty because they were required to always feel the pain of it. The deception, the horror, the brutality, the price of the gift. Maybe the old demons miss when we sacrificed bulls and lambs to them. As recently as the last millennium. They are aware that we are still here, but we don't sacrifice livestock anymore. Maybe they are angry about this. And every now and then, they build up enough energy to zap onto the rangeland and laser knife a bunch of parts that look tender, and then they eat it up like some blood fuel, and then they vanish in a flash of light. They disintegrate back into the ether, back into the psychic jet stream. Imagine a human being able to control that sort of divine, insane power. La Quema del Diablo, December 7th, Saturday night, all day, all night, I'll be on at 6 p.m., come by, $15, Sunday at the station, Silver Lake Flea, Holiday Market, I'll be signing issues and selling gift subscriptions that you can send to your friends and loved ones, Thursday, December 26th, Thursday, January 2, at the Ace Hotel as Desert Oracle Campfire Stories. Music tonight by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Good night from the voice of the desert.
Well, if you have any cattle mutilation stories to share, I would love to hear them. I'll give you the number in just a minute. So, right now I want to ask you, did you take part in this Christmas stroll? I hope you had a good time if you did. And that KGVM fundraiser is coming up. The poster says 12/14/24 KGVM Christmas fundraiser with the Love Darts, Dead Yellers, Big Blonde, Dave King Ropes, Taylor Wallace. So at 7 p.m., the doors open at the Labor Temple, 422 East Mendenhall in Bozeman. And there's a $15 suggested donation. So hope you can get to that. Sounds fun if you like a lot of rowdy fun. Anyway, my time's about up. If you want to reach me and tell me some of those cattle mutilation stories, the number is 406-404-6246. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. I think I'm going to keep walking.